Well, the bad news is that Professor Maxey can't be here. He has a family emergency. The good news is that this presentation of his that I'll give instead is relatively short, so I'll be able to get you out of here early. But of course, I don't have nearly Professor Maxey's repertoire of dirty jokes. And I'm not as comfortable telling them, but... So today we're going is the final substantive lecture. Remember, next week is the final exam in the class. It's going to be just like the midterm, except that it only covers the second half of the class. You don't need to review things from before the midterm. But otherwise, it'll be formatted and set up the same way. Everything's open book, open note. It will have a lot of questions about the A201 general conditions, so make sure you bring that with you. And generally, most people find it easier than the midterm, so don't sweat it too much. Also, I was told that there's a professor evaluation form that I need to have you fill out next week, so it'll definitely take the full class period. Make sure, I'll need somebody designated probably to come by, I guess if we're in this building, I can just deliver them upstairs, or Tom Parrott can. So next week is the final, and after that you're done with me and can focus all your time or whatever remains on the design projects that all the other professors tell you are the most important thing about this school. Today we're going to focus on something entirely different though. We're going to be talking really about economics. And I know that a lot of you are shuddering at that. That's why you're in architecture rather than in liberal arts. But it's not going to be quantitative. You do not need to remember the numbers or be able to do the arithmetic that you're going to see up here. The numbers are there to illustrate the concepts and to show you what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. Hopefully, it's simple enough that it'll make sense to you because it does to me, and I'm horrible with numbers. But when we get to them, don't panic at the sight of all these numbers and all these calculations. It's really the concept of what makes sense from the standpoint of a real estate developer. Now, the class is going to be using the paradigm of a multifamily apartment building. We're going to put together a pro forma, which I'll describe and explain to you on that. To start with, though, you need to understand that building types can be characterized differently depending on their economics. This is John Maxey's division of buildings. It's not my own. He refers heavily to something called the economic equation, which is really a return on investment concept. We're going to talk about all of that. One type of building is a building whose job is purely to function, has nothing to do with earning a profit or making money. That would be, say, something like a single family dwelling. I mean, profit really has nothing to do with that. It doesn't make money for its owners. A courthouse or a library, a building with a public function like that, isn't supposed to be a money maker either. Now sometimes you get hybrids. Even in a public building, you may have first floor retail space where there is a profit to turn. There are other buildings that are also intended to be functional but have to at least make economic sense. Buildings like hospitals or nursing homes are the examples that Professor Maxey has given, where function is the primary purpose of the building, but it has to be designed in a way that its function allows it to make economic sense. Hospitals or some healthcare type buildings often don't have to turn a profit because they're often owned by nonprofit organizations, but they can't hemorrhage money. They can't be big money losers, or else it will drain the charitable fund. Some buildings are intended to make money strictly through their function. A factory building is a perfect example of that. It has to make economic sense, but the economics are based on the specifics of the function. A factory building that's making something that's profitable is going to make money. Whereas if the very same building is producing widgets that nobody wants to buy, it's not going to make money. So it's not so much the architecture as it is the function that determines the profitability of the building. But the building type we're going to focus on today is the one listed as number four here, which is primarily an economic investment. People build these buildings or repair these buildings and renovate them for the purpose of making money. They're really driven by an economic equation. Developers and the people involved in the industry won't do the project or won't finance the project if it's not set up so that it's going to make a reasonable profit at the end. Sometimes that has to do with the nature of the economy. Professor Maxey likes to contrast the American economy, which is profit-driven, with the Hungarian economy, because he grew up in Hungary, which for many years, when it was controlled by the Soviet Union, was socialist and not profit-based at all. And he would point out, Professor Maxey points out the very different nature of the buildings in those two countries, where the socialist buildings were really just to be functional, because profit wasn't a motive in a socialist economy. The state owned all the buildings. They were intended to be functional as housing for workers and other citizens, but they weren't supposed to make a profit. They would go up because the people needed housing, not because developers were taking advantage of the need for housing to make a profit. And Professor Maxey would point out that the architecture of the two differed tremendously. That the buildings in a socialist economy were drab and unattractive and difficult to maintain, all kinds of flaws that left them undesirable because desire wasn't an important element in a socialist economy. People were assigned apartments, they went there, and there was no competition among buildings to attract tenants. Whereas in the American economy, whatever can go into making a building attractive to tenants or whoever it might be, adds to the profitability of the building.
How do you account for the shabbiness of recent development?
I think the reason for the shabbiness of recent development is that the economic equation has changed, that it has become so expensive to design and build that the only way to take advantage of the need for housing or whatever the function of the building is to build it quick and cheap. So that if somebody really took the time to put good architecture and construction into the building, it wouldn't make a profit. Absolutely. I mean, capitalism can be just as limiting if the economic conditions are limiting. If the American economy develops to a point where it's ridiculously expensive to build, then you won't see any construction. Even if you get to the point where it's more expensive to build than to use and renovate old stock, you won't see any construction. And that's not just hypothetical, that's what's happened in the last 2 years. Construction of, say, condominium buildings has died in the last couple of years. And there are many reasons for it, but one of the reasons is that the cost of housing has dropped tremendously. Almost a third or so has dropped from the value in the housing market. The short answer is that it's cheaper to buy someplace than to build someplace. So building just isn't going on. The economic equation has its pluses and its minuses. Now there are a number of different parties who have roles in the development of, let's say, housing, but it could be any kind of building structure. The one who is the entrepreneur who would say that they take most of the risks is the developer. This is the part of the person or company who conceives of the idea more or less and who acts kind of as the producer, almost like the producer of a play or a movie. The person who organizes it all, finds the people with the talent to do the various elements of it, and pulls it all together. Now, developers are an unusual species. Professor Maxey will wax eloquent about how evil many developers are. He may go too far, but he's got a point. Developers have to have an unusual mindset. It's almost like a Las Vegas gambler. They're in an area that has no promises. where they have to be responsible for creating their own value. There is no guarantee of return. They are gambling at every step. But that means that they are playing every corner. They will look for every edge they can get. And unfortunately, one of the edges is you. Developers will play you for everything that they can get. Now, there are some who are scrupulously honest and ethical. My experience is that they're in the minority. The majority of developers see absolutely nothing wrong with delaying their payments to you for months and using that money to finance their developments, from inventing claims against you and using that to try to get out of paying your last couple of bills. Or if there's a problem that's caused by their own corner cutting during the construction process, they have no hesitancy to blame you for accepting their value engineering insistences and incorporating that into your drawings. Developers make their money, essentially, by reaping a little bit of profit off everybody else who's involved in the process. So the incentives on developers are kind of nasty. The incentives are to cheat, to wheedle, to gamble, to do whatever they can to make money on the project. You'll see all kinds of developers who are, let's say, unethical or go way beyond the pale. Do you know what a slumlord is? A slumlord is a subset of developer who specializes in low-rent housing where they forego all kinds of maintenance, letting buildings fall apart around people, essentially, because if they were to maintain the buildings with the low rents they're able to charge, they wouldn't make any money. It's just another species of development. But you have to be very cautious when working for a developer. That means that if you're hired by a developer, you can't just trust that person to do the right thing the way you could, you know, a single-family residential client. You need to make sure your contract is signed before you start the work. If the developer asks you to perform an additional service, you need to say, I'm happy to do that, but you've got to drop me an email right away authorizing me to do it, because it's absolutely routine for a developer to ask you to do an additional service, and when you do and bill for it, for him to claim that he doesn't owe you any payment for it because it wasn't approved in writing, even though he verbally told you to go ahead and do it. It happens all the time. It's like the idea of defensive driving behind the wheel of a car. You have to practice defensive architecture when you are working for any client, but especially a developer whose livelihood is tied up in the profit of the deal, because they're going to try to maximize their profit at the expense of everybody else, and you're one of those everybody else's. Market analysts. Market analysts play a role in figuring out demand. They basically are consultants who survey people's wants and needs and try to figure out what demand there is for various kinds of building types and what supply is available in different areas so that they can figure out what kind of area is likely to support what kind of development. Usually a developer hires or works with a market analyst to develop his concept for the project. A market analyst might figure out that in this particular portion of Lincoln Park, there's a shortage of low-end rental units. And therefore, the developer will see that if he builds a low-end rental apartment building in that area, he's likely to have demand for his units, and they're likely to rent out relatively quickly. The reverse can be disastrous. If the developer builds something in an area that doesn't have a demand, it's got an excess of supply, he's not going to be able to rent out the units or sell the condos or whatever it is, and the building's going to ultimately go under. That happened a lot 2 years ago, that everybody was building condominium buildings in the same general wealthy areas to the point where there was such a glut on the market that whoever wanted to buy one had tremendous bargaining leverage and could get incredibly low prices. So the buildings weren't making any money, they were losing money. The market analysis is a very important element of the development decision. Probably an even more important element, however, is the lender. John here has it described as a mortgage lender, and that's probably a general category. The more accurate way to say it would be the construction lender. And there are different ways to put together an investment. However, the main way to make money at a real estate investment from the standpoint of a developer is to put as little of his own money into the investment as possible. Any of you ever see the Broadway show or the movie they made out of it called The Producers? The one with that starred Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick originally? I actually was an investor in that, which turned out really nicely. But there's a great line in that where Nathan Lane, who's producing a Broadway musical, screams at Matthew Broderick, who's trying to learn how, never, never put your own money into the show. Now that's an overstatement of a developer, what a developer does, but nevertheless there's some truth to it. Because the main way to make money in the real estate market is for buildings to grow in value, for the market values to increase, so that the building that you own on day one is more valuable on day 365. Because prices, real estate prices historically have always gone up, with the exception of occasional blips like the one we had a couple of years ago. And the less money that the developer has in the project, the more profit per dollar invested the developer makes. That's called a return on investment. And that's an important concept to know. It's really a ratio. It's on the top of the fraction is how much money is made total. And on the bottom of the fraction is how much money you had to invest in order to make that money. Let's just use an example. Suppose a building made a profit of $1 million, ultimately. Well, that's fantastic, let's say after the course of a year. That's fantastic if the developer only put $100,000 into it, because that means that his money multiplied by 10 times in the course of a year. If it cost him more, if it cost him $500,000 to do the project, it's still a good investment because his money doubled from $500,000 to a million that it made in the course of a year. But suppose he had to put in $990,000 to make the $1 million. Well, that's not that great a rate of return. If he had put that same $990,000 into a CD or a money market fund or something like that, he'd have made more in the course of a year than just the $10,000 difference.
Are you talking about the profit, or are you talking about the total value of the investment?
Really the total value of the investment, not just the profit. So, I mean, if he put in $900,000 and the building was worth a million more, or say a million total, his profit would be the million minus the $900,000 for a $100,000 profit in $900,000 in the course of 1 year. That's 1/9, which is about 11%, which is a good rate of return. Question?
I was wondering if there's a minimum cutoff for developers.
It would be nice. Developers would love to have a minimum cutoff, but that's the gamble. They may find themselves putting $1.5 million into a project only to have it be worth $1 million at the end of the year. That's a good question. Is there a minimum or a cutoff? And the answer is probably yes, but it depends, what the number is, depends on the economy. That's why the concept of return on investment is important, because real estate is just one possible investment. If the developer puts his $900,000 into real estate, at the end of the year he'll have a million, let's say. But if he were to put that $900,000 into the stock market, at the end of the year he might have well more than a million. If he were to put it into a bank account, a savings account, he'd probably have $909,000 or whatever it is, 1% interest. There are all different kinds of investments available in the economy. The developer's job is to make money, not necessarily in real estate. The only reason people will go into, the major reason people will go into real estate investment is because they have a chance to make more money there than in other alternative investments. And that's why the bottom line on what the appropriate rate of return would be to justify a real estate investment changes depending on what the other alternatives and options are. Now, in order to avoid putting a lot of his own money into the project, most real estate developers do two things. They syndicate the equity, and then they take a loan from the bank. What does it mean to syndicate the equity? It basically means bringing in investors, where suppose a bank won't loan 100% of the amount of the project. If you're going to need $1 million to finance the project, a bank will tend to loan 70, maybe as high as 80% of that, but not more. You're not going to be able to get a bank loan for more than 700 or 800 grand against a $1 million project. They want the owners of the project, the developer and his team, to have some skin in the game, to have their own investment be at stake. So the bank insists that the rest of the investment be equity money, ownership money. And the developer doesn't want it all to be his most of the time. So what he goes out and does is solicits the opportunity to various wealthy individuals who then invest in the real estate deal. They'll buy shares. Remember we talked about limited partnerships the second week of class when we were talking about partnerships and corporations and things like that? A limited partnership is an investment deal. You know, when I invested in the producers, the Broadway play, I was a limited partner. The producers of that show followed the same kind of concept that the developer of real estate does. They went out and found investors who were willing to put $25,000 into an investment that then would make and return profit depending on how profitable the play turned out to be. Same thing with real estate development. The real estate developer will show a pro forma, which is something we're going to talk about in a minute, basically a projection over time of profitability to the investors and show them how if the following facts are true, then for their $20,000 investment, at the end of a year or end of 3 years or whatever it is, they'll have made 15 or 20% on their money, which is a better return than they could get from a bank or a certificate of deposit or some other investment opportunity. So the developer puts up a little money of his own usually and then finds investors to put up the rest of the equity money until they have a quarter or so of the total investment in the property or in the project. Then they go to the bank to get them to loan the rest. Now, the bank loans against construction. The construction loan is an unusual kind of loan, not the kind you've seen before. Have any of you have a revolving line of credit on a credit card or something like that, where the more you've charged against the card and kind of financed against the card, the more they charge you interest on? If you had a zero balance, you'd be charged zero interest. But the bigger the balance, the more the interest. Well, that's how a construction loan works. The bank says to the developer, your money goes into the deal first. Now, what's first in the deal? Buying the land, doing the design, preliminary kinds of analysis, the market analysis, things like that. All of that is paid for with the equity money, either the developer's own money or the money he's raised from investors. But the construction is way beyond the developer's ability to finance. So they go to the bank and take out what's called a construction loan. That means that every time the contractor submits a pay request to the owner, to the developer, that pay request goes to the bank as well. And the bank loans the money to pay the contractor. And that's the first withdrawal from the construction loan that the developer makes. So on day one of the project, before he started to excavate, the construction loan balance is at zero. Now the developer has gone to the bank and he's made arrangements for this line of credit to borrow up to $700,000, let's say, against a million-dollar project. But none of it's been borrowed yet. So except for the fee that he would have paid to open the line of credit, he has paid zero interest. But that first excavation work is done, the contractor's bill for the work, the invoice comes in, and it goes to the bank. And the bank advances $75,000 to pay the contractors. Now the developer has drawn the loan. The construction loan is at a total of $75,000, and for the next month, the developer pays interest on the $75,000 he's withdrawn. And the second month, the second pay request from the contractor comes in, and the developer goes to the bank and withdraws $95,000 to cover that new pay request. So for the second month, the developer is paying interest on $170,000, the 75 plus the 95. And every month, the draw on the construction loan goes up and up and up until finally, at the end of the project, it's hit the full $700,000 maximum that the bank has agreed to loan. And now the contractor is paying a lot of interest. Now, at the end of the project, there's a change in loan procedure. Then the construction loan has been maxed out, and the developer goes either to the same bank or to a different bank and says, I'm now ready to take out a normal, traditional mortgage loan against the project. You know what a mortgage loan is? For any of you who own a house or a condo, it's the money you've used to buy it, and then you pay it back at a normal real estate lending rate. There's no construction risk any longer because the project's done. It's over. It's built. The reason that the contractor changes loans at that point from the construction loan to the mortgage loan is because the mortgage loan has a lower interest rate. What does he do with all the money he gets from the mortgage loan? He uses it to pay off the construction loan. Pays the total principal balance on the construction loan. That loan's over now. He no longer has to pay the high rate of interest that construction loans have. He's now just paying regular monthly interest on the real estate the same way you or any homeowner would. Now, why does the construction loan have a higher interest rate? Because it has risks that a mortgage loan doesn't have. What happens if the project gets canceled midstream? Well, the bank can foreclose on the real estate, just like a mortgage lender could foreclose on the real estate, but what do they have? They have a hole in the ground with some structural steel sticking up, not very valuable. In other words, they have to do something to that land to fix it up to make it worthwhile. Any of you followed the Chicago Spire problem? I mean, how the project stopped with basically a hole in the ground and a little bit of concrete poured? Well, I was the one who stopped it by filing the first mechanics lien. But the banks, the mortgage lenders, or the lenders against that property who had the construction loan are in quite a hole, literally, because that's all the property is at this point. They can take it back under a foreclosure process, but they have something that's not very valuable because they have to do a lot of work to it to, you know, refill the hole or to fence it off so that it's not dangerous to passersby.
Assume that they would not loan them very much at this stage of construction, right?
Correct, because there hasn't been that much construction work done. But the collateral that they have for the loan, the land itself, isn't nearly as valuable as it would be if there hadn't been any construction work done in the first place. So there are risks to the collateral for a construction lender and complications to taking the project back, all of which mean that it's a riskier loan and a higher interest rate. So the developer who needs the construction loan gradually during construction gets rid of it as quickly as he can by you taking out a normal mortgage loan to pay it off. So why do a construction loan in the first place? Why doesn't the developer just take out the mortgage loan from day one? Costs more. When you take out a mortgage loan, you're taking out the whole loan as a lump sum at one time. I mean, if you go and borrow $700,000 under a mortgage loan, the bank gives you the check for $700,000, and it starts charging interest on the whole $700,000. So from day one, the developer will be paying interest on $700,000. Probably not. You're right. They wouldn't really do it because the property will be under construction, unless the interest rate was ridiculous. But it doesn't make logical sense from the developer's standpoint because he's only drawing $75,000 of that loan or using it the first month. The rest of the money is would be sitting idle. So if you think about it, let's say that there is a construction loan that's being charged at approximately 8% interest. What would the real interest rate be on the loan over the course of the loan, if that question makes sense to you?
It depends on the construction.
That's exactly right. It depends how fast the construction proceeds. If you assume that the construction is going to proceed on a straight line kind of basis, where it's a straight curve rather than the typical kind of project curves, the cost of the construction loan that's at 8% would probably be 4%, because you're only drawing the loan gradually over time. At the beginning of the project, you've only drawn a tiny amount of the loan. Near the end of the project, you've drawn all but a tiny amount of the loan. If you were to average over the course of the project the total amount drawn, it would be approximately half the loan, because you're drawing the $700,000 gradually. Think of it like a graph going up like this from zero to $700,000. If you were to calculate the area under the curve, under the graph, it would be the same as if it were a straight line at $350,000. You know, it's basically, I don't know if you guys want to get into, it's certainly not a calculus question, it's basically cutting the square in half. And if you do it diagonally, that's the same as cutting the square in half right across the middle. But that means that a construction loan is the smart way to go for a developer, because the even though he's paying a higher interest rate by a point or two, the real interest paid over the course of the loan is about half, roughly, of the actual interest rate. So that's how a developer will work with a bank. The developer will take out a construction loan first, which is secured by a mortgage on the property, and when the building is done, he'll go to a different lender or the same lender and take out a totally different loan for the same building, which of course he never sees dollar one of. The entire loan is used to pay off the construction lender. And then the developer just pays a mortgage on the building that he owns the way any other building owner would pay that mortgage. Well, the way that a construction loan is phased really depends on the project. The project works based on a natural sequence of construction, starting with site clearance and excavation, then foundation pour, then structural steel, just to give you an example. You know how that sequence works. And the contractors all bill monthly. So the construction work and construction draws are phased based on the contractor's pay applications. It varies from project to project, but it's usually predictable fairly well in advance if you've done a schedule for the project from day one. That's a good question. After you have a construction loan, to what extent can the developer make changes to the project? Well, changes that reduce the costs are easy to make. That's not a problem. No one will ever object to that, except maybe the tenants ultimately. But changes that add extras to the project are difficult questions. What happens when you get a change or an unforeseen condition that causes the construction price to bump up over the $700,000 that the bank has loaned? That kind of thing is what gets lawyers involved, because some developers are so hesitant to put their own money into the project that they try to pretend that these extras don't exist. They fight them and refuse to pay the contractor, despite the fact that they really owe the money, and lead to contractor claims. Sometimes they look to make the money back elsewhere, such as by trying to pick fault with the design, and they make a claim against you for some amount of money that just happens to correspond to the overage they're going to have on the construction loan. Developers often develop this mindset that it can't be their own money, so that if something goes wrong with the project and bumps up the prices, then it's got to come from somebody else, not them. Now, sometimes a bank will recognize that the building has a lot more intrinsic value than they gave it credit for, and they'll increase the amount of the construction loan proceeds that will be available. Sometimes the developer has to come up with extra equity money, go back to the investors and say, we hit a bump. There was this huge boulder underground we didn't expect. Excavation costs were 100 grand more than we thought. We need an extra 10,000 from each of you, or else the project's not going to succeed and you'll lose your investment. All of those are different possibilities for the developer.
So what about if you want to make a change where there's no cost difference? The bank, at that point, only has a loan, or only agreeing a loan for construction costs. Does that mean that you can totally change the project, but it can still be the same amount of money, and the bank would care?
The bank would care, because the bank has to figure out that the project is going to be a success itself. And it won't loan money against a project that isn't going to be a success, because it's not likely to get paid back then. So the bank drafts very careful lending agreements, where the developer has to sign it and promise that every change to design will be sent to the bank, at least for notice, if not for approval, so that the bank can step in and prevent unwise design changes from being made. The developer supposedly gives up a lot of autonomy, when a lot of decision-making power, when it involves investors or especially lenders in the deal. But developers aren't always so scrupulous. It's not that unusual for them to just forget about it or ignore it and not bother to tell anybody about the changes that they're making. And most of the time, the bank doesn't have any way to find out on its own. So you see all kinds of situations where developers are accused of bank fraud. And in fact, I've advised a lot of architects who have been asked to do something by the developer that would really amount to defrauding the lenders or the investors, and I have to warn them what the risks are of going along with what their client wants them to do. Now here on this second slide is the logic of the pro forma. A pro forma is really kind of like a business plan. In this case, it's a business plan for the development of real estate. It has three real categories. It has a category of costs of the project, and then a category of operating expenses and operating income. The logic is that the operating income obviously has to be bigger than the operating expenses, right? Otherwise, the building is going on an ongoing loss. If the income doesn't exceed the operating expenses, then it's a losing proposition from day one. But not only does the income have to be bigger than the operating expenses, this is the operating income, it has to be bigger enough so that there's enough left over to pay off the costs of the project on a gradual basis. That's the logic of the pro forma. What a pro forma will do then is project these numbers out into the future. So it will figure out what the costs of the project are, and those are over. They're sunk costs, already incurred costs, once the project is complete. That's what the definition of them is. And then it will project the operation of the building over time. And it will show the income up here, and the expenses down here, and each year, the difference between the two will be used in part to pay down the costs and in part to return some profit to the investors. These are the different categories of cost, expense, and income. Think they could have given us a louder classroom? Maybe they won't stick us in the basement next year. That's probably true. So what are the costs that go into a real estate development project? And here we're talking about a multifamily apartment building. Well, the cost, well, the big cost, one of the big costs is land acquisition. Then local costs like utilities, extending sewer lines, et cetera, to the property and to the building on the property. There's the construction cost, which is obviously a huge cost. There are furnishings within the building. There's the fee that's paid to you and your subconsultants. There are legal and accounting expenses, because anytime you put together a deal of that complexity, you need professional help of that kind. And then there are all kinds of miscellaneous costs, like surveys, soil borings, printing for promotional material, things like that. And then there are marketing costs, like advertising or hiring sales representatives to rent out the apartments. Those are considered the project costs. And then, of course, there's interest on the construction loan. You add that to the project costs, and you have the total cost for the pro forma. Another way of thinking of this, this is kind of John's equation for it, is that all of the costs of the project, from all sources, minus the mortgage on the property, the ultimate amount that the bank is lending, is the value that's left over in the property, which is known as the equity. That's the portion that the developer and the investors own. And it makes sense. If the total cost of the project was, say, $1 million, and you had a $700,000 construction loan which gets converted into a mortgage, then the remainder, $300,000, is what's owned by the development team, which consists of the developer and his or her investors. Once you have the project built and completed, then you have to figure out the operating income and expenses. The operating expenses are kind of logical. You have to pay for utilities, although sometimes those are passed through, those costs are passed through to the renters as part of the lease. You know what that's called when the tenant pays for all of the utilities in addition to whatever the rent cost is? That's called a triple net lease. The idea is that the developer doesn't want the risk of charging X dollars in rent and then having utility costs to go up on him, so it cuts down his profit margin. And the way to handle that, the way to minimize that risk, is to make the tenants responsible for electricity and other kinds of utilities. You'd have each apartment then individually metered, which increases the construction cost a little bit, but reduces the risk of being stuck with utility bill increases. The expense of operating the building, having a doorman there, having a building superintendent or engineer, other personnel. There's ongoing repair and maintenance. There may be a management office that has to be operated on an ongoing basis. Those of you who live in big high-rise apartment buildings know that there's a management office pretty much open full-time, or at least normal business hours in those buildings. There will be continued marketing, because there are going to be people who leave, you know, whose leases are up and who leave, and new tenants have to be found. So the marketing has to continue. Insurance has to be paid. Real estate taxes have to be paid, and there are probably a number of different miscellaneous categories that I couldn't begin to name because I'm not a developer. All of that is the operating expense for the building. But it's not the total time-related expense. In order to get the total time-related expense, you have to add in what Professor Maxey calls mortgage retirement. It's basically your mortgage payments on the building going forward. So when you add those two together, you get the total expense of the entire investment. That has to be compared to the income from the investment. The income comes from primarily rent paid on the apartments, and any leases you have, and any office or commercial spaces. In a city, you can usually get pretty hefty rents for parking spaces in a garage. And that's all the gross income from the building when you total it up. But how often is the building ever fully rented out with every single apartment and parking space and commercial space occupied by rent-paying tenants? Well, it's almost never 100%. Just historically in Chicago, there's typically a vacancy rate you can count on, because at any time some of the apartments are turning over and they go a month or two without a new tenant having come in. The historical vacancy rate for Chicago apartment buildings is in the ballpark of 5%, more or less, which means that from the gross income, you've got to subtract 5% to get to the total net income, which is your cash flow year to year for the building. And your cash flow had better darned well exceed your total expense, or else you're losing money every year. So now let's put this together with a real project, or at least a real hypothetical project. This is all John's numbers. It's hard to see it all at once. But we're talking about a 12 to 14 story apartment building. Professor Maxey lives in Evanston and knows Evanston backwards and forwards, so he's using that as an example, because we're going to be talking about actual prices. And to make it easy to do calculations, let's assume we're talking about a development of a building that's going to have 100 apartments, each two-bedroom, about 1,200 square feet. And it'll include a garage with 100 parking spaces, and on the ground floor a little bit, about 5,000 square feet of commercial space. So let's look at the costs of the project now. The land, Professor Maxey is estimating at $2,500,000. He's calculated the cost of building the units. Now, to do that, he's used a general square foot kind of analysis, because at this stage, without a design, how can you do anything more? So he's figuring 100 units at 1,200 square feet is a total of 120,000 square feet to build. And then he points out, you can't just rely on that number. You've got to build in circulation. You know, corridors, elevators, garbage shafts, staircases, exterior wall space, all of that. And his rule of thumb, as somebody who's pretty experienced with this kind of building type, you know, that he wrote the book on multifamily housing. I think you're still using it, but it was his textbook that he wrote. He says that a good rule of thumb is to add 20%. For circulation space based on the total square footage of the apartments. And then there are common areas of about 7%, he says, as a rule of thumb. Those would be lobbies and other areas that are common space in order to make it a reasonably attractive building. And of course, we're talking about a little bit of commercial space for a total of about 159,000 square feet. Now, he uses a rough general construction cost that's a gross average of $120 a square foot. Now, of course, building a corridor is a lot cheaper than building a bathroom. So it's going to be nearly $200 a square foot for a bathroom or maybe a kitchen because of the heavy mechanical work, whereas it's going to be well less than 120 square feet for very simple architectural spaces, like corridors or vanilla box type rooms. So he gets a rough estimate of $120 a square foot for construction cost, and of course that can change over time or whatever, for a total construction cost for the building itself, for the inhabited areas, of just over $19 million. And then there's going to be a garage, but of course it's a lot cheaper to build a garage. He estimates 350 square feet per automobile, per parking space, including ramps and space to exit and things like that, and a much cheaper construction cost for garage than living space of $70 a square foot. So that ends up totaling $2,000,004. And when you add all of the hard costs together, the land acquisition, the living space, and the garage space, the total hard costs come to about $24 million and some change. Now, how can he put these numbers on it? How can he put come up with $120 or $70 a square foot? That's experience. That he's been in the business a long time and seen a lot of these different projects. I don't know if he could tell you that that number is valid today, but any developer who does this kind of work needs to have a rough understanding of what these construction costs are. And my guess, based on my recent experience, is that Professor Maxey's numbers are kind of close. 3 years ago, I'd say they were low. But in the current economy, I'd say they're probably pretty close to exactly right. So those are the hard costs of the project. But then there will be soft costs, too. The construction loan for the project, he has estimated at 24.3, which is based on the hard costs, basically the construction costs.
And you said that would only loan about 80% of...
Yeah, I think he's overestimated here. That's why I'm not holding you to any of these numbers. I don't expect you to be able to come up with a per square foot construction price or an actual amount of a construction loan against any particular project. This is illustrative only, and frankly, I don't know that John's numbers are exactly right or based on all the right assumptions, but it's important to understand the principles. You can dispense with the math, though. But let's take the assumption, true or not, that the construction loan will be just over $24 million. It's not that, that's not the, a soft cost. The soft cost is the interest on it. So how do you calculate the interest? He's using a 7% interest rate calculation, but he halves it, remember? So it's not really 7% of the entire amount, because he's not, the developer isn't drawing the entire amount at once. The developer is drawing the loan gradually. So the total effective interest rate will be in the ballpark of 3.5%, which works out to $841,000 of total interest. And lenders charge a fee to set up a construction loan line of credit. So the lender will typically charge 1.5% of the loan as a fee. So the total soft costs paid to the bank will be the 841 plus the 360. And then you have the architect's work, your work, which he's got calculated as 4% of the construction cost. And if he were here, he would probably tell you, you can't really do it for that. Remember his last lecture, first half of the class, where he was telling you that you really can't make a profit in your architecture firm at 4%. You really have to charge 4.5, 4.75. But we're using this assuming that the architect has been able to negotiate, the developer has been able to negotiate the architect's fee way down, which you will find developers trying to do, playing you off against each other. Professor Maxey will tell stories where he's been marketing for a project. He and several other well-known, well-respected architectural firms have made proposals to developers, and the developer decides to chuck them all and go with some young, unknown architecture firm that's just starting out and operating out of its basement or garage because they have so much less overhead and are willing to quote a well below market fee. Developers will do anything to figure out a way to reduce the costs and put more of the profit in their own pocket. And then there are legal, marketing, and other miscellaneous costs that Professor Maxey estimates in order to make the project go. So the total soft costs end up being a little over $2 million. And when you add that to the $24 million hard costs, you get 26 and change in the total cost, as the total cost of the project. Now let's go to the income and expense sections. Now these are over time. The costs that we just did are sunk costs, essentially. Those are the costs that are paid one time in order to get a finished project. These are the operating expenses and income that occur over time. So he estimates apartment rents at $1,600 a month, multiplied by the 100 apartments, and multiplied by 12 months, for annual operating income from the apartments of just over $1.9 million. He thinks he can rent out parking spaces in the garage at $200 a month, for a total operating income annually of $240,000. And he estimates the commercial space being rented out at $100,000 a year, for a total, a subtotal, of $2.26 million per year in operating income. Of course, there's a vacancy factor, the 5%, so you have to subtract 5%, which leads to a total estimated income of $2.147 million. Let's compare that to expenses, total operating expenses. Management is salaries, utilities, maintenance, taxes. Professor Maxey says that there's a reasonable rule of thumb at calculating those kinds of management expenses at about 40% of the operating income. I guess that may be an average, but I don't think that it's a hard rule or anything like that. But since we can't know in advance what the real operating expenses will be, that's as good a rule of thumb as any. That ends up being about $859,000. And then the mortgage has to be retired as well. If they're paying 6% of the mortgage amount every year, that means they have to be paying 6% of $22,365, which is the amount of the total mortgage, the total loan that's still outstanding, for interest payments of 1.341, which means the total expenses on an annual basis will be just over $2.2 million. Uh-oh. Because the total income is only $2.1 million. That means the expenses every year are a little bit greater than the income. And we end up with a net loss of $53,000 to $54,000 every year. No go on the project. If your pro forma, which you know, you work this out and show, ends up with these numbers, stop the project. Don't do it. You're losing money every year. That means if you want to calculate it as a return on investment, the equity is about 15% or so, he's calculating, of the $26 million. In modern times, with all the banking problems that are going on, equity is probably a higher percentage. But using these numbers, the equity investors are losing about 1.4% of their investment every year. John's conclusion is that it's a poor investment. Well, that might be true. It might actually make sense. There are things called tax dodges, tax-type investments. You always wondered what those are? There's some magic that some lawyer invents in order to help people save taxes? Well, the way this is structured right now, this is a tax investment. It works only if you're in a market where real estate prices are going up year after year. If that's the case, this investment can still make sense because you'll be losing 1.4% of your investment every year. That's a loss that the investors can write off on their taxes. Every year, they can take a loss and write down their taxes by the amount of that loss, which keeps their total tax payments way down. But if the real estate is going up, let's say, in terms of price, 3% a year, then they're actually making money because their total value of the building is going up 3% every year and they're only losing 1.4%. So they're netting out 1.6% gain every year. But the way the tax laws work, they don't have to pay any money on the real estate gain until they sell the building way in the future. So they're postponing all the taxes on their gains to the future, but they're getting all the benefits of the losses today, every year. So this would be a great tax dodge if you could count on the real estate market continuing to go up. But that's not why this development was, this development or this project was conceived. This developer wants to make money. So here is Professor Maxey's suggested fix to the development, to the project. He says, we can get away with charging higher rents. Man, this is Professor Maxey says, if this is built in the right part of Evanston, you can easily get away with charging rents for a 1,200 square foot apartment at $2,000 a month. I believe him, but I have no way of verifying that myself. And look at the changes that that makes to the economic equation. The costs, both hard costs and soft costs, are exactly the same. Those don't change. It still costs the same amount to build and complete the project. But the income changes. The expenses, well, we'll talk about that in a second. If you look at the income change, you'll see that now we're talking $2.4 million in income from apartment rentals, which ends up netting out to total income of $2.6 million and change. Sure. To figure out how much you need to charge in order to make the development work. A good developer will try all kinds of different permutations of numbers to figure out how he makes the most money. He won't know until he does the pro forma what the outcome would be of charging $1,600 a month. Typically, a developer would try $1,600 a month because it's easy to rent out the building at that rate and find out, I can't do it for that, I'd lose my shirt. So then he will try $1,800 or $2,000. And this is just one example of an alternative that he might try. As a practical matter, the developer working with the market analyst will try to figure out what the highest amount of rent that he can get away with charging based on supply and demand. If charging $2,000 or $2,200 a month in rent would cause there to be very little interest in the apartments, then he can't get away with that. So he has to understand what's called the market elasticity, for those of you who have taken economics classes, which show how supply and demand work based on apartment rental prices.
Wouldn't you work your way down in prices as opposed to working your way up?
You know, I can't tell you that the developer wouldn't do it in this sequence or the other sequence. I'm just showing you this first so that you can see the difference in consequences. Very well, the developer might have started at $2,500 a month and figured out that that didn't fit market conditions. You know, what they will really do is they'll have a calculus of what the outcome is with every different single possible permutation and figure out where they make the most money at the end.
I'm a little confused as to why you're
That's a very good point. Remember that Professor Maxey's assumption was that it's a general rule of thumb that management-type expenses for the building are approximately 40% of the operating income. Personally, it looks to me as the only change he's making is to increase the apartment rents, then the management costs would presumably stay the same as they were in the prior go-round when the rents were lower. You might argue, on the other hand, that people who spend $2,000 a month for an apartment will have a higher expectation as to management personnel, quality of service, and things like that, than somebody who's spending less, and therefore you might need to do a better job or have an extra employee. I really can't answer that, and I don't expect you to know that. That's really developer decision-making. But if you are to use the same rule of thumb of 40%, then the expenses go up a little bit because the income has gone up somewhat. And you have the same mortgage retirement, but a net total expenses of almost 2.4. But here you're making a profit. Here you have expenses being $220,000 less than income. So you have an annual profit of $220,000, more or less, which when you calculate it based on the equity in the investment, the return on the equity investment, that means that the investors are earning a profit of 5.6% a year. Well, that's not that great in the marketplace, actually, because there are a lot of other investments where you can earn more than that. You can put money in tax-free municipal bonds and earn 4 or 5% that you never get taxed on. But there's also the real estate increase in value. If the real estate appreciates, say, 3% a year, the same percentage we were talking about before, then the equity investors are really making 8.6%. every year, and 3% of that is tax advantaged because it's not cash. It is a capital gain from when you sell the real estate, the paying of tax on that is pushed into the far future. So the total value of the return on investment, if you're to calculate it like an accountant, would be in the 9 or 10% range when tax consequences are included. And I'm being way more technical than you need to know, because your developer client is thinking like this. If you ever want to think like a developer so that you know how to attract them and appeal to them, those are the kinds of approaches that a developer will take. Still, a question?
Yes,
you mean on the increase in real estate? When there is what's called a realization event, which for most of the time is when the building is sold. So when you sell, it's like on your own house. You bought your house, let's say, a few years ago at $200,000. You're going to hold on to it for 10 years, but then you've started a family, you need a bigger place, so you turn around and sell it. But now the market's gone up and you can sell it for $300,000. You've just made a cash profit of $100,000, but you don't pay the taxes on that $100,000 until you sell the building, until you sell the house. Because until then, it's all hypothetical. Who knows what you're going to be able to sell it for? But once you do sell it, then you compare your what you received for it, your sales price, with what you paid for it. And the difference is called a capital gain. And you are taxed on your capital gain, usually at a lower rate than you're taxed at ordinary income, because of the craziness of the U.S. tax laws. So it's an advantage to you in two respects. It's a lower rate of taxation, and it's postponed. Even though you're gaining 3% a year, you don't have to pay any taxes on the gain until you actually sell.
I think that's separate from
the sales tax, right? Right. A sales tax really applies not to real estate, but to personal property that you buy, and you pay a sales tax on each purchase to the state through the vendor. Yeah, if the capital gains tax were decreased and other taxes weren't increased to make up for it, it would make certain kinds of investments more attractive than others. And the kinds of investments that would be most attractive are the ones where the gains come as capital gains, basically the appreciation of property rather than just profit that you make. The tax laws have a big effect on decision making and investments for your clients and ultimately for you as well. So the smart architect business person follows these decisions and follows the rules so that they know what's likely to happen in the marketplace. And in fact, the AIA and all other kinds of publications that you can subscribe to predict this for you and simplify it for you. They will have somebody who writes the Washington Beat, and they will have a story about the proposed change in the tax laws and how it's likely to affect architecture business. So it's not like you have to figure all this out for yourself, but you need to at least realize that for many of you, your livelihood will be tied in some way to the real estate market because you're an integral part of it. So even the favorable kind of pro forma for an apartment building with rental units didn't yield the world's greatest investment, return on investment. It wasn't that big a profit. That's why the condominium market has come into being. That's why for a while, there were so many condo buildings being built and so few rental apartment buildings being built. Because when you do the economic equation for condominiums, you'll find that the developer can make a lot more money. I'm not entirely sure why there's such a difference in the market. Personally, I think it's emotional. I think that people like to own something, and they're willing to pay more to own it, knowing that they can turn around and sell it, than they would be willing to pay an equivalent amount of rent spread over time. So it's the old American dream of home ownership in some way. But here's how the economic equation works for the condominium market. The hard costs for building the building are the same. Although, between you and me, condominium buildings tend to have nicer features, better architecture, higher quality construction, because people are looking at them in an ownership sense. People want a higher quality when they are buying to own something, when they're just compared to when they're just renting and living there for a period of time. So personally, I don't think that the hard costs would be the same, but that's the assumption that Professor Maxey is following. He also suggests that the soft costs would be the same, but with some additions. Because if you're going to sell condominium units, you're going to have to do what's involved and necessary to sell them. You're going to end up selling them through a real estate broker. And brokers charge a percentage of each sale, as those of you who have bought a home may know, usually 6%. So if you're going to be selling all the condo units once, you multiply 6% of the total the total cost of them, and you get $1.4 million. Now, I don't think that's the right way to do it. I think you have to figure out what the purchase price of the condos is going to be and multiply that by 6%, but it works out to a number pretty similar to this. Lawyers have a much harder job with a condo building than an apartment building, because each one is a separate piece of real estate. Each unit is separately owned. There's a lot more paperwork to prepare. Similarly, a surveyor has a lot more work to do with a condo building, because each unit is separate, which means he really needs to do a three-dimensional vertical survey. And the survey is going to be surveying boxes in the air, essentially. And there's a heck of a lot more work involved. So the total soft costs increase.
So the broker is more fees than the architect.
Yes. Brokers, I mean, there's just a market for brokerage, and it's typically 6%. It's rare to find something as low as 5%, but believe me, developers will look for a deal. With 100 units, they'll try to make a deal with a real estate brokerage firm that says, hey, I'm not just giving you a listing, I'm giving you 100 listings, and it's not a whole lot more work for you to learn about all 100 than it is to learn about one or two. So you should give me a reduced rate for the brokerage fees, because there's an economy of scale in what you're going to be doing for advertising and everything else, which means that probably a good developer could negotiate a broker into cutting its rates. These are just basic assumptions. So the total costs are going to be just under $28 million. Now, Professor Maxey says, if you want to make, let's see whether it's theoretically possible to make a 15% profit on this project. That's a lot more than the apartment building profits we were talking about. So he adds 15% to the 27.9 and comes up with a total of 32 and change as the total amount that you need to get out of the project. And the question is, can you sell the condominiums for enough to make up that difference, to justify a $32 million project? And John says yes. John says that if you divide the number by the 100 condos that are going to be sold, you get approximately $320,000 per condominium. And he says that's a reasonable assumption in Evanston. You can get $320,000 sales price in whatever market he prepared this for a two-bedroom, 1,200-square-foot condo in a good location in Evanston. I can't verify that, but this is the approach that you would follow in order to figure out whether your condominium project makes sense. And the reason that condo buildings get built so much more easily is that you get your profit out pretty quickly. You're basically, once you've sold all the units, you have all of your money out of the project. And basically it's like flipping the building, selling it quickly. And developers like to get out of a project and use their profits to move on to the next project.
I'm wondering about the profit projection here, because you're talking about 15% profit on the total
cost.
Total value, whereas you're actually putting up 20% of the cost, and the financing of the rest is included in your cost. So you're actually making a huge amount of
profit. Correct. Although there's a Right, although it's a 15% of this number, because calculated as a return on investment, it's a lot higher than 15%, because the investment is a small fraction, 20 or 30% of the overall costs that go into the project. So you're right, the return on investment is way higher than 15%. That's a good point. And that's what we were comparing the other projects to. I think one of the reasons this works is that the developer gets out from the maintenance. What this doesn't show you is that once people have purchased the condominiums and formed the condo association, they then become responsible for running the building. They have to pay for all the ongoing maintenance and all the other costs that are going on through their assessments. So all of the operating expenses that go into the calculation of an apartment building can be dispensed with here, because the operating expenses are going to be borne by the people who buy the condominiums. Now, there will be a period of time during the sales process when the developer still owns most of the condominiums and is paying a lot of the operating expenses himself, and that's not calculated in here. This is pretty much an oversimplification, but it gives you an idea of how the condo market is so incredibly different from the rental apartment market and why it's become so much more popular. The only thing that's killed it in Chicago is the oversupply of condominiums. Because it was so popular and all the developers were going this way, there were way more condo buildings being built than there were rental apartment buildings. And the condo buildings would go under. The development would lose its shirt. The whole project would lose its shirt because their assumption of being able to sell the units turned out to be wrong, because there was a glut on the market. So when they had to absorb not being able to sell so many of the units, they ended up having to pay for the units, pay their share of maintenance costs, and the project went under. The bank would then take it back and sell it to the highest bidder, who would often turn it into a rental apartment building at that point, because there was still a strong demand for rental units. Now, the difference between purchasing and renting units really shouldn't be underestimated. Professor Maxey likes to tell a story about Eastern Europe and about how it changed when the communist regimes were dispensed with and overthrown. While they were still in power until the Iron Curtain fell, the apartment buildings were all owned by the state, and they were in terrible repair. The occupiers, the tenants, really had no incentive to keep them nice, because they didn't have any kind of ownership interest. They didn't benefit if they were the ones to maintain the units. So the units looked terrible. The buildings were lacking in repair. It was really ugly. But when the Iron Curtain fell, what happened was that the tenants ended up owning the buildings, very much like a condo building. They owned their units and had a joint ownership of the building. And John says that you should look at the difference in Eastern Europe today. Those buildings are pristine, they're beautiful, they're well kept up, they're more interesting architecturally, that everything about them has changed once the mode of ownership has shifted from the state to the individual. And that may have something to do with the condominium demand, because people want to own, and they don't seem invested in the real estate unless they own it. And it may just be a psychological thing, because there's not a whole lot of difference between owning a unit for 20 years and renting it for 20 years in terms of what you get out of it. So I don't know that it's logical, but it certainly seems to be a function of how the real estate market truly functions. The other thing that you need to know about condominium development is what I call the legal crisis in condominium work. Condominium work is scary for architects. Here's what is happening today, just so you know, and the trend is just beginning. I mean, it's not as well established as it will be 5 years from now. Developers, to make the most money out of their condominium projects, are cutting corners. They're having you value engineer down your designs to minimize cost and to cover up or hide the lower quality elements of design. They're also allowing contractors to cut corners, to cheapen the construction. When it comes to buying mechanical systems, a good rule of thumb is to have a margin of safety of extra power of this much. Developers are ignoring it, and cutting the margins down to next to nothing, which means that more and more things go wrong with condos over time, because instead of being built in a real, true luxury sense, they're being built as tightly as they can possibly be in terms of cost and expense without the kinds of extra power, extra quality that you would like to see built into them. Of course, none of that is advertised to the condo owners. Have you ever seen a condominium advertisement that talks about how well we've cut the corners and how you'll be satisfied with your average quality, etc.? It's never that way. It's always sell, 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 luxury, deluxe, etc. So condo buyers are believing that they're getting terrific quality because that's what they're being told by the developers, and they move in, the condo association is formed, and they find water leaking through bad flashing in the envelopes, they find inadequate HVAC type systems, and a whole host of other related problems caused by doing slipshod work, sometimes by hiring cheap contractors, sometimes due to value engineered designs. So condo associations don't know what to do about it. Typically, in the past, they just kind of repair these things and consider them to be ongoing maintenance type items. But now there's a breed of lawyer who is taking advantage of this. The lawyers are going to the condo association board members. Let's say you sit on your board, the condo board, and they're going to you and saying, you know, as a board member, you have what's called a fiduciary responsibility as an elected member to all your constituents, to the other condo owners. You have a duty to them to do what's in their best interest to maximize the ability to fix all these mistakes and problems in the building. If you don't take action to have all these things fixed, they can sue you. You could be personally liable for neglecting the maintenance of the building once you've been elected to the board role and you have that responsibility. Now, there's so much truth to this. It's not entirely true. You're protected. You're insured. There are a lot of other things that can protect the board member, but most board members are really scared. They say, I didn't know I was signing on for this when I ran for election to the condo board. What should I do? And the lawyer says, you should sue. The condo association should file a lawsuit against the developer for all the construction and design defects. Because after all, they not only told you the building was fine, they told you it was deluxe and luxury, and it ain't. And the lawyer will then cause the condo board to file lawsuits that had never been filed before, or at least in a greater frequency than those that had been filed before. Condo boards, once they get formed and the developer is out of the project, sue the developer more often than not these days. And what does the developer do when he gets sued? He says, remember, the developer's credo is, not out of my pocket, it isn't. So the developer turns around and says, you're complaining about construction defects? You're complaining about design inadequacy? I didn't build it. I hired somebody to build it. I didn't design it. I hired somebody to design it. So I'm going to file lawsuits against them. And if there are design or construction problems that I'm liable to you for, well, then they're liable to me. And you can see how that affects you. Because you're just trying to make your client happy during the construction and design process. And now your client is turning around, and for each of the value engineering decisions that he insisted you make in order to bring the project in on budget, his very low budget, of course, he's suing you for design inadequacy. Yes, the MEP system isn't as powerful as it probably should be for a margin of safety, but that was impossible given the low budget he forced on you, so you have the cheapest MEP system that would possibly work. And that's because of his decision that cost is more important than life cycle considerations. Well, now he's suing you for the very decision he forced on you. And as a result, architects who do a lot of condominium design are finding themselves sued more frequently than any other kind of architect. It is the single greatest source of lawsuits and claims in the entire architectural industry. In fact, when you go to buy professional liability insurance, one of the key questions that the insurance company will ask you is, what percentage of your work is condominium design? And if it's a high percentage, your profits on your premiums, insurance premiums, are going to be sky high if they choose to insure you at all, because it's such a risky line of work. You know what else contributes to it? These claims are even more prevalent in Florida, California, Arizona, South Carolina, and the reason is boredom. Believe it or not. You have retirees who have a lot of time on their hands, and they have nothing better to do than to run for these condo boards, and then the lawsuit that they're being told to file is a source of excitement and entertainment. It's something for them to do. It's no risk to them, and except for the monies that they're paying to their lawyer to prosecute the suit. And they have more time to kind of try to find problems with the building and more interest in the ongoing suit, so that you will find that those Sunbelt states tend to have almost double the number of condo claims that you find up north where there isn't quite as big a retirement community. But it's become an actual industry, condominium claims. Just the right question. Thank you for the segue. What do you do to protect yourself from this kind of claim? Well, the first thing you need to be aware of is the risk. When you are agreeing to design a condominium building, you have to know, you have to remember this class, and remember that there are risks down the line. As nice as the developer seems to be, as honest and ethical as you think he is, the pedal hits the metal when the lawsuit is filed against him. I haven't yet met a developer who doesn't try to pass it through to the architect. The not out of my pocket credo is universal among developers. And that means that you need to protect yourself, to anticipate that lawsuit ultimately being filed and to protect yourself. So when the developer lowers the budget on you, you need to respond by saying in writing somewhere that it's possible to design a structure at this level, but it will be a relatively low quality structure with all kinds of maintenance and life cycle kinds of concerns, and that needs to be made clear to the ultimate users of the building. And if you write that and he says, well, do it anyway, then when he comes to complain to you about having designed a low cost MEP system, your answer is, I tried to warn you about this, but you insisted. I have no choice but to follow your instructions. Once I've warned you of the consequences and you don't care about them, then it's your fault, not mine. The fault isn't that I designed this system. The fault is that I warned you about the risks of this system and you told me to go ahead anyway. So what you need to do is to keep a written record of the decision-making process for all of these value engineering or budget-driven decisions that you're ultimately forced to make, and to be able to use them to defend yourself against the claim that, well, they're talking about design, that's your issue, not mine. The same thing is true when you're doing periodic site observation of the construction. You will probably see contractors doing things differently than you expect in a cheaper kind of way, and you need to have a written record of warning the owner. Classic example is flashing on a masonry building or something like that, where you'll see the contractor not following Brick Institute of America requirements for flashing. You need not only to reject the work or notify the contractor, but make a written record to the owner of what's happening and recommend that he either have full-time inspection by some kind of masonry inspector or some other tactic or technique to stop the contractor from cheating. And the owner, the developer, will ignore you because he wants the contractor to cheat in a sense, because he's paying the contractor a smaller amount, expecting the contractor to be cutting corners. If he were to insist most of the time on all of these different procedures being followed, he would never get the kind of bids that he's getting to do the work cheaply. So you need to anticipate that and protect yourself. Remember when we talked about the three different kinds of documenting a communication? We talked about putting it in writing and having the other party sign it as the best way. We talked about the confirming letter approach as the second best way. And we talked about the note to the file approach as the third best way to document a communication. You need to keep those three types of documentation clearly in mind on a condo project, because you'll need to use them as appropriate to make sure there's a written record in your file for when the condominium developer ultimately turns around and blames you. There isn't a solution that you can put on the drawings that will make your client happy, because if you design it the way you think it ought to be designed, it'll be value engineered out, or it may be. So you can't protect yourself that way. It may even be value engineered out without you knowing it. The contractor may later go to the owner and say, listen, I know that the drawings call for this, but you can save X dollars if you let me do something else instead. And the contractor and the developer may by themselves say, okay, that's what we'll do, and never even tell you about it. So you won't even be aware of all the value engineering decisions that are made that can affect you. I'm not telling you not to do these kinds of projects, but I am telling you that they come with a high degree of risk, and you're capable of protecting yourself against them, but it seems counterintuitive to be taking stances that are kind of adverse to your developer client, especially because you're still in a honeymoon period. There's no adversity between you at all at this point. So it looks almost as if you're creating dissent by documenting things like this, and yet you can't let that control your decision making. Any questions about what Professor Maxey would call the economic equation, the way your developer clients will think? You don't have to be a developer, but if you want to work for developers and want to be successful at it, you need to understand how they think and even how they put numbers together, because that'll tell you what will make them happy and what won't. And it will also tell you where your risks are and where they aren't. So thanks. As I've told you before, I've enjoyed teaching you guys as much as any class that I've ever had here. I think you really think for yourselves and have, you know, except for the economy that you're going to be facing when you get out, have really bright futures ahead of you. Next week, if I had the answer to that, I wouldn't just be teaching class. I'd be in the Obama administration right now. But next week, as I told you, is the final exam. If you have any questions or any issues or you need to review anything or anything like that, these remember, all the lectures will be posted on my website. I'll have this one up by tomorrow as well. The handouts are all up there as well. Definitely get familiar with your A201 general conditions. You don't have to memorize it, but definitely bring it to class and know your way around it. Know what kinds of things are in the various articles, because it'll save you a tremendous amount of time. Feel free to email me with any questions you have. That's probably the easiest way to do it, because I may respond with a blast email to the whole class if you raise a good question that I need to clarify. The final is a little bit easier than the midterm, most people tell me, and it probably won't take the full 2 hours of class, although you'll have 2 hours. The administration is going to make you fill out a teacher evaluation survey. We'll do that right after the final, so I'll need you to actually sit here and fill it out and stick it unseen in an envelope that Tom Parrott will probably come down to get. Any questions? Or?
Can we fill it out before?
I'm sorry, what?
Can we fill it out before we start the exam?
Sure. Yeah, in fact, you can leave when you're done anyway, because once you finish the exam and the form, you give me the exam, you stick the form in a covered envelope, and then you're free to go. You don't have to wait till everybody fills it out at the same time. Question?
Yeah, I have another question.
Yes. You're talking about young developer development set firms?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'll quote my son when he was in 11 years old, and he was involved in some kind of fundraising for the American Lung Association at the time, and somebody asked him, well, how you were able to raise so much money, and his answer was, you know a lot of people with money. And actually, there's a lot of truth to that the investment scene really is driven by private individuals in this country way more than anything else. What you need to do is to impress people with your abilities and honesty, I guess. Make them like you and trust you and respect your abilities, and you will find that people are anxious to find investment opportunities. An architect is in a tremendous position to make more money off investment and development than off architecture. I mean, some of my best friends, especially in the suburbs, have practices where they're looking all over for teardown type houses and find them and buy them cheaply because they're usually run down and in lousy shape, not costing a lot of money. And then they basically demolish them and build in either the same footprint or a new one, something that's much more appropriate. They design it themselves. They usually act as their own general contractors by running the trades through sequentially, almost like design builders, but they're really doing it as developers. You know, it's not rocket science to build a single-family house. You know which trades have to go through in which order. I mean, you probably know that as you're sitting here today. And end up then developing a relationship with a real estate brokerage firm that will help them sell it, you know, if they're not able to sell it by owner. And they make more money from the development and sale of the real estate than they would make from all the hourly rates they could charge as architects during the same period of time. So it's a real possibility. And after you've got a track record of having done one or two on your own, then it's very easy to attract investors and not having to do it with your own money. But it's a relatively easy thing to do if you start out at a relatively small scale, and then you can build up if that's what you want to do. Although I find that a lot of architects don't want to build up, that they're really happy flipping a couple of houses a year and making, you know, several hundred thousand dollars based on the development every year, which is a pretty good living in the architectural industry. Playing golf is one way of meeting people. There are a lot of other ways. In fact, I have a client who's perfected a way of meeting people through the library system, that she gives talks on elements of architecture that are routine to you. I mean, just showing slides. Sometimes she's showing her own work and just trying to get people interested. But there are a lot of, especially suburban and nice area of the city, families who don't really understand architecture and want to learn for their own purposes and their own future living. And it's an easy way to not only make contacts with people, but to get them interested in you and your work. And it's been a practice builder for her. If she hadn't been doing that, I don't think she'd have survived, you know, the last downturn. And instead, she's doing great. So there's no one right way to do it, but that certainly is something that worked for her. You know, as you have these ideas, you should keep in touch with your faculty members here, I mean, at least the ones who are practical. Professor Maxey is willing to give out his email address to anybody and happy to consult. I mean, if you have a question about what kind of fees you should be charging for a particular project, I can't tell you, but he can go into it in some detail based on projects that he's done in the past, and he's happy to help. If you have legal questions or business questions or something else that I can help you with, 5 or 10 years from now, feel free to drop me an email. I mean, I hear from former students all the time. Most of the time, I'm able to answer it with a quick reply and, you know, happy to help. Sometimes they'll have questions that are so complex that it requires some real legal work, and I tell them that up front. But rarely, I mean, that's just not the way it works. Typically, I hear from, I'd say, 2 former students a week. So don't hesitate to use the faculty here as continued guidance even after you've graduated. So I'll see you next week, same time, same place, and we will do the final exam and be done with this class so you can spend your time on all the important design-related activities that the rest of the faculty feels is critical. See you next week.